It's a great honor for me to be here. I've followed the Cultures of Malik project for the past several years, so I'm very pleased to be here to talk a little bit about my current research here at Oxford, and then more generally about text mining or data mining applications for humanities and social science research. I say a little bit about my project because it's very much a work in progress, and for the first 5 months or so, were spent moving and manipulating and munging, as they call it, data. So if you do any text mining or want to do any text mining, be prepared to spend an inordinate amount of time shuffling data around until you get it into a good format. And then once you do, the walls fall and things become a little clearer. But so I'm just now beginning to sort of get some fruit. The project's just beginning to bear some fruit, which we'll see at the end. But I did want to address more generally text mining, what I call text mining, because as a literary scholar, as a traditional literary scholar, I'm interested in text. Data mining is a larger field. Machine learning is even larger than that, but they all sort of fall within this rubric. And the question, the main question would be, how are these applicable? What are the to humanities research, what are the ramifications? And how can they move scholarship forward? What are the questions we should be asking of these technologies? These are, after all, approaches developed in computer science, in information retrieval, used for the most part in commercial enterprises to monetize your interaction with the web, if you will. So how can thinking of Google's ranked relevancy or Amazon's recommendation engine or your everyday spam filter, these are all ideas behind, these are all machine learning and data mining ideas. How can we use those and should we use those? So this comes within the context of what's called big data. Now everyone's talking about big data. And it's true that this data mining is a function of a sort of overabundance of data these days. In the humanities, big data probably means something quite a bit different than big data. In the hard sciences, in French, they're called les sciences pures et dures. But just to give you an idea of the scale, these are the sort of sets that I work on. The complete works of Voltaire, 1,000 words, 7 million words. The Encyclopédie, which I'll talk quite a bit about today, of Durand d'Alembert, housed in Chicago, which is actually 28 volumes, 22 million words over 74,000 articles, moving up to Electronic Enlightenment, which in the build that I use is 56,000 letters, 23 million words, Echo TCP, which is 18th century works online, 75 million words, Artful Frontex, which is, this is Artful is the group out of Chicago that I began working with. This is the large French database of 3,500 volumes, 250 million words. And then finally, at Northwestern, we have this behemoth, Early English Books Online, uncorrected database of 23,000 works, and just about a billion words. And so I would consider that big data. Even maybe a scientist might consider that big data. And so this is in a general, this idea of a sort of ever-growing number of books in which to contemplate brings me back to a pertinent question by Gregory Crane, who is the director of the Perseus Digital Library. And this was made in 2006, so he's a little bit prescient. And what to do with a million books is his question. So we were approaching a million books in 2006. Greg rightly surmised that really only machines can process this amount of information. What does it mean to us as scholars? Since then, 2006, we've greatly surpassed a million books in the digital library. We have at least 5 million books now in the Google Books project, 4% of all books ever published in English. And with this comes a new discipline, if you will, of research called culturomics. And culturomics, as it claims, is a purely rigorous quantitative approach to culture. And it extends, as they claim, the boundaries of rigorous quantitative inquiry into a wide array of new phenomena, spanning the social sciences, humanities. I don't really have time to get into my methodological reservations about culturomics, other than to say that on their panel of esteemed information scientists, there was no humanists involved. And to praise them at least a little bit for putting their data online with a sort of transparency that you can play with it. Caveat emptor. And so here we can trace from 1900 to 2008 in the English corpus the unigrams, or one word, internet, compared to World Wide Web. We find this, I guess, intuitively. It reaffirms what we would expect. 1990, we get this explosion of the internet. World Wide Web is much less used. Maybe WWW would change also. But then apparently from 1900 to 1910, people in the Belle Époque were talking about the internet. This is called an error of in metadata. And the people at Google and GramViewer and Culturomics, they'll get around this with, I guess, would nicely call data bullying, and they'll just say that, well, it's statistically insignificant, these errors in metadata, so we don't need it. We're just interested in the sort of word frequencies and distribution, and if that small error exists, then that's okay. Make of it what you will. If we go into the 18th century, and we know there's all sorts of problems in this. And here would be the example of a graph that I, as a scholar of the 18th century, find particularly, well, I find it insightful superficially before I think about it, but maybe that's the point. So this would be religion in blue, plotted against philosophy and works in French in the 18th century. Someone who works closely on the Encyclopédie, I find it sort of, as I said, superficially gratifying to find from 1750 to 1760 this great spike of philosophy, right when Diderot is publishing the Encyclopédie. I don't quite know what to do with this apparent rise in religiosity during the revolution. If I could go back into the text, but there's so many of them, it doesn't really matter. I'd get lost in this sort of swimming of text. What I would say, actually, what this is resonances not of philosophical contemplation, but of anti-philosophical campaigns against the Encyclopédie from 1750 to 1760, and then anti-clerical campaigns around the revolution. But without this sort of mechanism in which to return to the sort of text, well, I can just leave it up to just conjecture in many ways. And so with this sort of problematic relationship, this is just frequencies and distributions over a huge amount of books, we can see that a return to the text or textuality in itself becomes problematic. And so other scholars working in other fields have decided, a way around this then is to get rid of text itself. And so to read, or what I call not reading, at a distance. And so Franco Moretti at Stanford is famous for popularizing this idea of distant reading as opposed to close reading, which would be the sort of immersive close reading of the traditional scholar. And here Franco Moretti claims that if between very small and very large, he's really mainly interested in metadata, the text itself disappears. This is a case of less is more. If we want to understand the system in its entirety, and this is the important part for him, if you want to have this meta sort of analysis, this macro analysis, if we want to understand the system in its entirety, then we sort of accept losing the text and its specificity. So there's all sorts of, distant reading is now this great, it's taken on in America and people love it. And so any sort of visualization is in essence an idea of distant reading, as you can tell by his title, graphs, maps, trees. So Franco Moretti was interested, he's a historian of the novel, and so he graphed all of the titles in the 19th century published in America, for example, to sort of see what trends emerge just from looking at the metadata. Here, and this is a project close to Cultures of Knowledge heart, I think this is Scott Weingart with another example of distant reading. This is a network theory. And so he's doing all sorts of fascinating work. I think he's at Indiana, and he's been able to talk to you. And so this is the sort of Dutch Republic of Letters visualized as, well, they're close together as a sort of network analysis, sociological network analysis. It's a good example of distant reading, but it's, for me, one of these visualizations that I could stare at for hours and maybe not, I don't know, he could explain it to me, but it's quite nice. Another way of thinking about this, and this is another project, another friend of the family, if you will, is Dan Edelstein's Republic of Letters, and is a good friend of mine, and this is, in fact, based on Electronic Enlightenment metadata, and this is an example of a geographical information system, which is a fancy word for a map, or rather, it's actually more precisely data associated with a map. And this gives you all the letters from electronic enlightenment from 1700 to 1750. This is a good interface. This is a nice interface. I like it. The one thing I worry about with any sort of visualization is that it gives you, this is the Republic of Letters. It gives you a sort of false sense of security that this is it, that this is there. No, this is the Republic of Letters. This is the network as it exists, when it's in fact just the data as we have it. Data change. This is Voltaire's network as we have it. And if somebody said just naively, well, this is Voltaire's network, Dan's example, famous example is, well, what about all the letters to England? He doesn't write to England. Well, in the data that we have, this is true. We can see it clearly. But we know he did write to England. We have some letters. He even lived in it. This is a letter to Pope from 1726. He lived in England for 3 years. He was one of the most avowed Anglophiles of his generation. The fact of the matter is that at the time when he was probably writing England or corresponding the most with England, he wasn't famous. And so no one bothered probably to collect his letters. We don't know. This is conjecture. This one is collected because he wrote it to Pope, who was already famous. So my worry, this is Rousseau's correspondence network, and Rousseau does write to England, but that's because at the time when he's corresponding with Hume, he's already famous, so maybe it's a function of celebrity. I don't know. The question, what I would like to raise with any visualization, with any data mining, is that there is a certain valorization of uncertainty that I like to raise, and that if we can begin to represent that uncertainty, what's not in the data as well as what's in the data, I think we can move things forward. But again, I'm interested in text, and these work great because they're metadata driven, and they don't have any text. So there's still no way to sort of return to the text if I wanted to think about moving from a macro analysis to a micro analysis, which would be from a distant reading to a close reading. Then this is what everyone tells you in distant reading. This is what it's supposed to be for. It's supposed to provoke a hypothesis. You go back to the text, you change it. But they don't. There's no inroad back into the text here. I don't know how to get from this visualization to the letters, or to the letters that aren't there, more importantly. So that's what I'd say about distant reading. Here we can put the networks together. And I mean, these are all good. Importantly, is the idea that that not reading has a long history, and it's not just distant reading come about now. If we think about the sort of rise of the NL school in history in the late 1950s and 60s, there was a real quantitative turn in history in French historiography. So Henri-Jean Martin, Lucien Febvre, history of the book, history of ideas, they began to count things, right? So they began to count death inventories, library holdings, archive, publishers, vocabulary titles. So I tend to put any new technological approach into a larger context, or intellectual context, that is. And we even have pre-digital visualizations, if you will. Actually, this reminds me, if anyone works on the physiocrats, there was Quesnay has a tableau économique, which has all these zigzags in it, which Mirabeau, his friend, said the zigzags gave him vertigo. And so that's one of my favorite 18th century anecdotes about visualizations. But here we have from Robert Darnton what he calls a communication circuit, and this is from his book on the lost 18th century bestsellers. So, you know, these things are in the air. Now we're becoming more technologically aware. These things become easier to do and to understand. So ideally, my idea in putting this into context would be to connect not just the technology as it exists on this sort of bleeding edge of as the newest thing comes along, we throw it at our data, it spits out this weird graph, and we say, this is great, and we move on to the next newest thing. I don't think that's a way to go through. I think we can move from not reading and distant reading, from metadata to the text, through text mining, which is what I'd like to talk about today, through a sort of mediated return to the text using various technologies. And so by not reading, and the scholars have done this for a long time, this goes back to 19th century philology, we examine concordances, frequency tables, feature lists, classifications, their accuracies, collocation tables, statistical models. If I put this in the context of 20th century scholarship, I'd say this is something along the lines of Curtius tracking literary topoi, or Kassel Begriffsgeschichte, the sort of conceptual history, the idea of concepts changing over time, and tracing semantic patterns between categories across genres and other things. So the distant reading and text mining together can provide larger and ever larger context, so the scholar can sort of move forward with and get back to close reading. And so text mining here then should function as it was designed to, which is as a pattern detection device, right? And here is a quote from Ian Witten, who literally wrote the book on data mining. And data mine for him, and for pretty much everyone, is the extraction of implicit, previously unknown, and potentially useful information from data. So this would be a sort of my idea with the Republic of Letters map is that those are explicit relationships. Voltaire sends a letter, it goes somewhere, it ends up somewhere else. You track that as a line. There are implicit relationships that hopefully we can forage or drill out of the data with text mining. These patterns, when you find them, you can generalize them and make predictions, as we'll see. Many patterns, and this is also important, are completely uninteresting or banal, and some will be spurious, contingent on accidental coincidences in the particular data set used. So your data is important, the tasks you set up, things that you consider, all can change the outcome radically of your text mining thing. So now in the news, everyone wants the topic model. And topic modeling is sort of black box, and you throw text at it and it comes back with the themes, what the text is about. Well, it can come back with 20, it can come back with 200, whatever you tell it, it's a sort of arbitrary thing. And then it's up to you, and you say, this is a topic, I recognize this. This means, I don't know, naval warfare, but this means nothing. Well, I don't know, maybe it means something to something else. So there is always this sort of idea that we should have a critical eye to these sort of tasks and where they're going. And now I divide up text mining in a purely arbitrary manner into three different categories. One would be a predictive classification where your algorithms learn categories from labeled data, then they predict on unknown instances. This is your spam filter at work, right? This is spam, this is not spam. Don't give me what is spam. Give me what is not. There you go. Comparative classification builds upon that from learning categories from labeled data. It finds accuracy, right? It can build a better spam filter, if you will. This is what Google's done. This is why you don't get any spam in Google, because they've learned the most important features, the accuracy rate, or the errors. They've gone through there and do that. And then finally, thirdly, we can measure similarity between documents or document parts, looking for meaningful connections. This is called unsupervised machine learning. And for predictive classification, just quickly to go through the three categories and give you some examples, as I said, this is a sort of spam filter or recommendation system model. Computer reads text, and by read I mean it counts words. Whatever types of words you want, can count two words or five words or lemmas or bigrams, but it basically just counts. And it sort of assigns features that are most associated with a class. For humanities, I think these are important because we can, as we'll see, we can extract classes or labels from a contemporary set of documents, let's say an encyclopedia or a dictionary, and then you can use that classification model with other works in that time period. And so it sort of lets you get around having to use anachronistic or modern systems of classification. The problem with humanities collections is that information space, as it's known, can be quite noisy and almost incoherent. And so a computer scientist is very careful about his data, what he admits, what he doesn't. We as humanists tend to say, let's get as much text as we can and we'll sort it out later, which is fine. So if we take the Encyclopédie, on which I've worked quite a bit, of Diderot d'Alembert, so it's this great 18th century philosophical work, it was a sort of tailor-made machine learning, data mining test bed for us, because in the sense of classification, it has 74,000 articles, of which 13,000 were left without classification. Here we have the article Beau, classified in metaphysics. 13,000 articles didn't have it. So as the first test, would say, let's train the classifiers on the 60,000 known instances, which in its original was about 2,900 classes, which is couldn't tell you about the sort of richness of the classification scheme of the editors of the Encyclopédie. We generate a model which is known in computer science as an ontology, And then we use this to classify first the unknown instances, the articles without classification, and then to reclassify the entire work. The resulting model was optimized to 360 classes, and this is an important point, where the algorithm is saying, no, Diderot, 2,900 classes is completely inefficient. I can get all of your articles, all 74,000, into 360 classes. Not one more, not one less. And this is the optimal number that you should have. And so this works great. As I said, from a computer science standpoint, this is what you do. You optimize your algorithms. But as a humanist, you should be wary that you've gotten rid of so many different classes. And it raises this question again, which that Franco Moretti brings up, this loss of specificity. So in trying to understand a system in its entirety, is it okay to lose the text? Is it okay to lose this sort of all the 2,600 classes just because you can map it better? And these are questions that are open for discussion. Certainly, it does help in it does a remarkable job considering what it does. So if we look at some of the results, the Discours Préliminaire of D'Alembert is this great philosophical project of the Encyclopédie, comes back as philosophy. We're very happy. Demi-Parable comes back as algebra. Great. Bois de chauffage, commerce, I'm happy, sure. Canard in ornithology, thank goodness. And then you have Chartres. And so these charters, let's come back as jurisprudence. So you get these, what it does is it builds these huge meta categories, right? So all these really tiny Roman law, ecclesiastical law, law of the nations or whatever, all that gets thrown into jurisprudence, right? So you build this huge meta category. And then maybe you're a little taken aback by the last one because maybe it should be in jurisprudence, but it comes out as ecclesiastical history. But then again, if you supply the mechanism to return into the text, you can go and investigate this and see that, well, maybe it does belong in ecclesiastical history. There's quite a bit about the church. But at the very least, it sort of allows you to think about it a little more in depth. If we move from, this would be predictive, to comparative classification. So these were classifying unknown instances. If we now reclassify the entire Encyclopédie, this allows us to test the accuracy of the model to extract the most salient features. So what are the most importantly weighted words for an article to be classified in ornithology? It might be feather. It might be, I don't know, it might be something you don't even think of, but it's important that you put the features out there. And then to find the errors or the misclassified instances, and they're not really errors because, I mean, we'll see. But my point is that this is where we as humanists can really distinguish ourselves from computer scientists, where they really want to get rid of all the misclassifications. You want a model that goes to 100% optimization, right? And if you have to throw out some things, so be it. Optimize. I remember in Chicago we had a meeting, and they were trying to guess the gender of speakers in Shakespeare. And they were using Hamlet. And I looked at their data and I said, well, there's something wrong here. There's no Hamlet in Hamlet. And they said, yeah, he talks too much. He had too many, he unbalanced their model. And so they took, and I said, you can't go to a humanist and say, I took Hamlet out of Hamlet. And they said, well, it made the model run better. So these are, it's the case where classification errors actually can be sort of rich sources. It can be a really heuristic tool, if you think about it, for seeing where these things diverge and why, and for provoking thought. So the idea is not to replace what Diderot and D'Alembert did, but to provide perhaps a tool for thinking more about it. And here we just have an example of three misclassified instances. And we can see why, perhaps. So in the first one, Acru, which was a very small article, its original class was probably too specific. Marchands de filets, so net merchants. I think there's only one instance of this classification in the entire Encyclopédie, so they were a little too specific here. But Acru happens to be these little metal loops that hold nets together. And so it gets put into fishing, which is a bigger category, so fine. Tepidarium belongs actually to the class literature, which is a problematic class in the Encyclopédie. All the sort of Roman antiquities and Greek antiquities, it gets all thrown into literature. Tepidarium is a sort of Roman thermal bathhouse, right? But the article is actually about how they built it, and so it gets put into architecture. So maybe you could say the computer's smarter and it's putting it where it should go. I wouldn't say that, but it's thought-provoking nonetheless. And then the last one is my favorite, because ashe are these little worms, bait worms. And so it's classified in fishing, but the article is not about the worms or fishing. It's about how you can cultivate your gardens to ensure that you have bait worms all year long. And so it's all about plants and gardening and tilling the soil. And so it comes back as jardinage. So again, as heuristic tools, I think these are good ways of thinking about navigation, of looking at the encyclopedia and other 18th century works. But they're certainly not meant to replace the classification scheme of the encyclopedia. But they can be used for other things. So this model can then be used to classify other texts. Here we have Diderot's Elements de Philologie by chapter. We can classify using the same model of the encyclopedia. Most of them come back as anatomy, medicine, physiology, which we're happy with. Avertissement comes back as literature, which I think is fine. Des êtres sont beings is metaphysics, understanding metaphysics and grammar. Will is ethics. And so the idea here is to sort of expand the way that... So don't rely on somebody to tell you what this text is about. Use a contemporary model or ontology and then classify these other works. This allows us also to think about the organization of knowledge in the encyclopedia itself. So in as much as our 360 classes are an abstraction, they were just as guilty. Clearly, there's not 2,900 classes of knowledge on there. This is their analytic table they published at the beginning of the Encyclopédie, which tells you how knowledge is organized, the interconnected of it. It's based, by and large, on Francis Bacon's tables. And so we have memory. It's facultative. So we have understanding, which is memory, of which comes history, from which comes history, reason, from which philosophy, and imagination, from which poetry, right? And so this is clearly an abstraction. D'Alembert says as much. And so if we use our model to plot and cluster the classes, so where the classes, where they approach each other in lexical similarity, we get a sort of different idea of the organization of knowledge in the encyclopedia. And it's perhaps a more forward-looking model than the facultative model of Bacon. And as much as we think at the top, we have here what we call humanities and social sciences, geography, literature, grammar. These are disciplines that came into being in the 19th century. But this is how the encyclopedia looks organized when we run the map. Physical sciences in the middle, and then down below we have the biological and natural history. So again, these are ways of taking the model of knowledge that we get from the encyclopedia, reshuffling it, using it as a sort of heuristic way of navigating and of going further and perhaps changing your idea of how knowledge is structured in the encyclopedia, in the text itself. This is all based on the vocabularies of each class, if you will. So for each class, they were clustered. And so this is an example of the third type of text mining technique, which is similarity. So you would take all the class, so the class metaphysics has 150 articles, all the words, filter out some, all the words in those 150 articles become associated with the label metaphysics. It's plotted as a vector, then you plot everyone else, and that's how you get the clustering, right? So this is unsupervised learning in many ways, and this is where you get a sort of idea of clustering, topic modeling, and other things. What you do, and this is, again, for a humanist, might be scary, documents are just bags of words, which is an inelegant way, but it's the technical term, actually. So word order is not taken into account. In fact, you throw out all the most common words and all the least common words, and you go for a middle ground. You treat these bags as vectors. So if we think, if we had an entire vocabulary, which was over many documents, which was just four words, amour, ancien, livre, et propre, if you had one document in which amour and book occurred three times and amour once, this would be your vector. So you have the full vocabulary, this is your vector. And this is how you plot similarity, if you want. And so we did this with the Dictionnaire de Prévoux, which is a contemporary or a predecessor of the Encyclopédie. We took all of its 72,000 articles, compared them to the Encyclopédie, and you run the vocabularies, you make your vectors, And then you do a measurement. In this case, we did the cosine of the angle between two measures, but you can imagine, I'm certainly not mathematically inclined, but you can sort of see how this goes. If our two articles were exactly the same, vocabulary-wise, they'd occupy the same space as a vector. If they're very, very close, then their vectors approach each other, and you can measure that, and you can spit out scores. And so this has been a sort of a fun experiment, but we're not sure where to go with this, because what happens is that if you compare a very large article to a very small article, it could be either not similar at all or very similar, just depending on the size of the articles, right? Because there's so many words used in, let's say, the article encyclopédie that it's similar to almost everything. So it depends on where you want to go with these. But you can, again, as heuristic devices, you can uncover some interesting things. In this case, Voltaire has the article Gloire in the encyclopédie, which is most similar to another article, Vanité, by Voltaire. So you could say, well, either glory is vainglory, or it's just Voltaire writing both the articles. You can say whatever you want. Again, with an idea that you'll return to the text and actually make these decisions. You go through Gouvernement d'enfant is interesting. It's not by Voltaire. But in fact, if you go in and read it, it's very important for aristocratic families to ensure the glory of their next generation. So that the governments of their children is very important. Christianity, it goes without saying, is of course glorious for the encyclopédistes. And then Pau, which is, have you ever been to the town of Pau in France? Wouldn't strike one as glorious, but it was the birthplace of Henry IV, which we know that Voltaire found him the most glorious of French monarchs. And in fact, it is an article about Henry IV and not Beau at all. It's that one sentence, Beau is found in this place in France. And who was born here? Henry IV. Let's talk about Henry IV. So this is a known strategy in the Encyclopédie where they said, this is not a biographical dictionary. We will not talk about great men and certainly women. But in fact, they did, and what they did is they put it in geography articles, right? And so here we get astronomy, which is similar to geography, which is similar to chemistry. These are big articles, so the similarity here stretches our definition of similarity for the computer. They're quite similar. Then you get down comet, moon, okay, I'm with it. Walstrop, which is this town in England. I don't know what it's called in England, maybe it's called Walstrop, but in French they call Walstrop. And so you say, well, what's this? Well, that's Newton's birthplace. And so the article is not about Walstrop, it's about Newton. And so it is, in fact, somewhat similar lexically to astronomy. But this is the particularity of the encyclopedia and of this model. And so, again, this sort of the idea that you could get rid of the specificity, or you should get rid of it, I think is a bad idea. And I think you should allow people to get back at it and find out the particularities of any text, even big, giant texts. And so clearly there are strengths and limitations to all of these, especially this sort of similarity measure. With this idea that there's no text order, that the sequence is not taken into account, as a sort of literary scholar, I don't find that particularly appetizing, but there we are. So, and it requires documents of similar size if you really want to get something good. It works for email, it works for other things, may not be good for running text, certainly. And it can reflect the similarity. Again, we have to problematize the term similar, because people have you have your own idea of what's similar, right? And this is based on word frequency and distribution, and that's all. And so you could have two articles where head words in completely different classes happen to use the same amount of words and the relatively same frequency or distribution. To the computer, they're completely similar, and to you, they have nothing to do with each other. And so how do we get around these limitations? And we're finally coming in to my researcher. This gives you this long sort of context to get in here. What I would say is that to get from distant reading, macro analysis, back into micro analysis or immersive close reading, we should think about mapping intertextual relations between texts. And so this is running text in order. And here we use a technique called sequence alignment, which is borrowing from bioinformatics. John Coleman tells me that the computational linguists had it first, but I'll let them argue about who did it first. But in fact, it's a sort of it's a known issue in computer science, where you identify regions of similarity shared by two strings or sequences, known as the longest common subsequence problem. It's used in bioinformatics, used in computational linguistics. Plagiarism detection uses these algorithms. Text collocation, you can imagine in a different way, so finding regions of dissimilarity in two like manuscripts. In French, they call this genetic criticism. And so you can imagine there's all sorts of applications for this in bioinformatics, which is this new great interdisciplinary field. Sequence alignment, a way of arranging sequences of DNA or other proteins, and identifying regions of similarity that may be of consequence. And along with this is an increasing sort of idea that there is a DNA, a linguistics of DNA, that the, that these cells and these sequences have a lot to do with the way that we use language and the way that language is formed. So the application of these sorts of algorithms to text is not that revolutionary, but I think it could provide, it could prove to be very, very fruitful in many ways. And so what we do with these, this approach of sequence alignment, is we use n-grams, and n-gram being a group of words of n number, filter out function words, content words, and we only use content words to filter out function words, and then we adjust the parameters. So we have to really have a very flexible system because of differences in orthography, corrections, OCR errors, just all the sort of particularities that happen in humanities data. And here, this is what it looks like if we take Rousseau's first two sentences from the social contract: l'homme est libre et partout les dans les fers, tel se croit le maître des autres qui ne laisse pas d'être plus esclave que. If we break this down into what are called trigrams, so an n-gram of three words, we flatten accents. That's how we get our sequences. We have homme libre partout faire, partout faire quoi, and you can see there's an overlap. And so when the system compares two texts, it finds like the trigrams, it registers that, it measures the sequence where it stops, and then you can consult it later. And so you can imagine there's all sorts of avenues of very interesting applications for this. In the Encyclopédie, it's been particularly fruitful in thinking about how it was an encyclopedia, so of course it was a work of compilation, right? Of course they had to get it from everywhere, but we're not sure how. Citation patterns and practices were very different in the 18th century, and so we find all sorts of borrowings. I would hesitate to call any of it plagiarism. I would call it sort of borrowings the sort of ideas of compilation. Here we find in the article on Spinoza, in the Encyclopedia, a large borrowing, in fact, the whole article is almost borrowed from Bayle. There's some reference to Bayle, as in Bayle had a lot to say about Spinoza, but there's no quotation marks, there's no idea. And the interesting part about this final one is that the Abbé Yvon not only borrows from Bayle without citation practice, but he finishes in his voice, right? He uses the first person pronoun, je finis par dire que plusieurs personnes, and so he finishes exactly as Bayle finishes one of his notes, with a small change at the end between water and fire. Sometimes these borrowings are more explicit, I would say. Here, in a sort of relatively in the bottom, we have a relatively innocuous article on charges by Boucher d'Argis. Diderot here intervenes with his star, his asterisk, editorial star, and he says, before passing on to these other articles about charges, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you what l'auteur de l'esprit des lois has to say about the venality of charges. So l'auteur de l'esprit des lois, everyone would have known reading this, this is Montesquieu. It's not named by Montesquieu, but I mean, it's not radical. People would have known this, the public at the time. But now we can begin to think about where Diderot ends, Montesquieu begins, and think about linking these passages right into the sort of chapter verse of the Montesquieu text, and seeing how that's a sort of a weaving together of citations that the Encyclopédie does. We can use works in translation. Because of the flexibility of the algorithm, we can use uncorrected OCR. Here we have a later translation of Locke's second treatise from the Gale Echo collection. This is pretty good OCR, but you can still see certain errors. SF is a nightmare for 18th century texts. But we find fairly clearly where Jaucourt is using Locke And the second treatise is never cited in the encyclopedia. And so when we look at how these sequences occur, how they're using it, we began to formulate this sort of idea that there were citational practices or strategies in the encyclopedia. And many times it was a function of the publication status of the works they were using. Now, this is for contemporary modern works, they could cite the ancients all they wanted. If for modern works, they had to change, which means that citing La Henriade of Voltaire, which was an uncontroversial work, that's not a problem. You can cite him all you want. But if you tried to cite the Lettres Philosophiques, you could get in trouble, right? It was a burned and banned work. And so how does this play out? Well, either you can sort of cheat, and here we have Jaucourt citing directly from the Lettres Philosophiques, Lettres sur les Anglais, as it was known, but using a different title, a sort of more innocuous title, and he has quotation marks and says, comme dit Monsieur de Voltaire dans ses mélanges de littérature et philosophie, so this mixture of literature and philosophy, I don't know if the English letters are in there, but here's a quotation. In other ways, you just sort of hide it all together. De l'Esprit was a very dangerous tract. It was a materialist tract that was published in the late 1750s, which was banned and burned again by the Parlement de Paris. And in fact, it was responsible for the Encyclopédie's revocation of its privilege in 1759. But Jaucourt likes Helvétius, and he wants to use him. And he adds in the second line down, c'est dit un beau génie de ce siècle. So it is, without quotation marks, without any sort of indication where the quotation begins, he gives a little tip of the hat. It is as a un beau génie de ce siècle says this. And so this would be a sort of nod to the connoisseurs, right, to the people in the know that he's citing somebody important. In this case, Helvétius. Maybe there was a code. Voltaire, when he's cited as a historian, as l'historien philosophe. There's un grand génie de ce siècle, which is normally Montesquieu. So you can begin to see different citation strategies. So this is an article that's coming out in the Journal of History Ideas, where we sort of went through, Dan Edelstein, Robert Morrissey, and I, using this technology to go through and see how these dangerous works are cited or not. And so finally, we come to electronic enlightenment after all this time. But you can imagine how, if you move out from the encyclopedia and how they cited works, if you have the sort of all the canonical works of the 18th century, you can imagine why I wanted to come here to use these sort of technologies to examine electronic enlightenment, this huge collection, corpus of letters, to see how there was a circulation of ideas, of sequences, of passages, of borrowings, and how this happens. And so the first thing that I did, which took a while, but was to compare the entire electronic enlightenment to itself using these alignments. So that's 55,000 comparisons to 55,000, which is, I think, 3 billion comparisons, right? So in computer science, we say that, or they say, it's computationally expensive. So it took a while. So this is not something that you can do on the run, right? Have this system and look at all these. So you run it and you leave it and you go home and you eat dinner and you come back on Tuesday and hopefully your computer didn't crash or die. And if you did, you run it again. But then you begin to think, the first thing we got out of this was a list of what the system thinks are duplicates. And this was important, one, because we know there's a lot of duplicates. And two, because it showed us that we were on the right track. At least my build was on the right track. So here we have a letter from Locke to Boyle, and another letter from Locke to Boyle. It's the same letter, and you might ask, well, why do you have two letters? Why do you have the same letter twice? Well, one, the left one came from Locke's correspondence, the right one came from Boyle's correspondence. So it makes sense. There's slight differences, but this is a great way. I think we identified about 2,000 pairs, so that doesn't mean 2,000 duplicates, but 2,000 pairs, which you can go in and you can begin to think about versioning, right? You can begin to think about constructing. Maybe there's three letters that are the same. Maybe it occurs in someone else's. So this was a first sort of step to using this technology with electronic enlightenment. A second thing that I'm very interested in is the idea, it's a very early modern scholarship, the idea of commonplace books and the way that these sort of commonplaces circulate. So here we can use someone like Pierre Bayle, who was this fountain of erudition, right? And so he's always quoting the ancients or other people in his correspondence, and we can start with him and we can begin to see, well, where does what Bayle says occur in other people, and how, and what is it? And so we come up with here This is from juvenile satires, right? So it's dat venium corvus vexit censura columba. So the censor approves of the raven, but he then censors the dove. So it was this, you know, juvenile. So then it gets passed. I wouldn't say passed around. We have to not think about these in genetic senses, right? This doesn't mean that Locke is using something. No, it's a commonplace, right? This is the thing. But you can now begin to track how these things circulate and move around, and we get back into this idea of networks. Voltaire in 1754 uses it in defense of Bolingbroke to one of his friends. We can see it again from Bayle, something that occurs in Bayle, and then much later in Hume. This is from Horace's Odes, Never Despair. Rest is important, but the Never Despair gets picked up and then gets tossed around all over. Locke again uses it. Horace was a great source for the Fido stuff. He appears in Boswell and then in Pickering. It goes to North America, so it's in New Hampshire. In 1789, comes back to France in 1800. If you think about it this way, where he's talking about Madame de Staël. So in the modern period, we get right back in there. This idea of a bigram, which is very, which is almost the smallest thing you can measure in text, but you can begin to think about networking. If we think about, so that's one way, that's using electronic enlightenment in and of itself as a sort of closed system to see how these things in the correspondence work. My initial plan, and this is what I want to work on mostly, is to take the Artful database in Chicago, which I've made a selection of works from 1100-1825, compare this to the correspondence and see what some similar authors are using, where they cite different sources, what they use, and to track it. So of the 73 million words, 1400 texts, we get about 2700 aligned passages, which means nothing, actually. It's just a number to throw out there. It's either impressive or disappointing, depending on your point of view, but it is what it is. In the 16th century, we get 122 passages. Montaigne is not surprising that we get him because he was, like Bayle, always quoting the ancients. So he's a good test, another good test. If you have Montaigne, you can go back and you can see what they're deciding, what they're using. Sometimes they cite it quite a little bit differently. And so these are ideas of ways of getting back into the text. The Gargantua one is interesting because this is the case where Rabelais, it's still in Latin, but Rabelais has made up this proverb, magis magnos clericos non sunt magis magnos sapientes, so the greatest clerks are not always the wisest men, which Montaigne himself refers to in his essays in 1595, and this goes on to have a great, this is one of Voltaire's favorite little lines to cite with his friends, so we can move from Rabelais to Montaigne, then into the electronic, then to the correspondence, where it, just a selection in 1758, he uses it talking about Rousseau as the new Diogenes, who crying from the depth of his barrel. barking from the depth of his barrel, right, as Diogenes would. And then he uses it again in 1758 to D'Alembert. He uses it to Helvetius, talking about the sort of scandal of de l'esprit and Palissot's Les Philosophes. He uses it in 1763 to his friend Anne Laville. And then his secretary, Wagner, uses it in 67 to the same correspondent. And you can see that that sometimes they use it with citation. The important part is not that we're not finding anything. You can see the numbers here, all the notes. So it's not like we're uncovering new ground here. But what we're doing is, one, we're confirming that we can find these things. And then, two, we can begin to construct a sort of thesaurus or collection or database of these commonplaces and then track how they're used over time. If we look at a contemporary event, so the earthquake in Lisbon was November 1st, 1755, had a profound effect on Voltaire, on his entire generation, really. So Voltaire writes this poem, Sur le désastre de Lisbonne, in December of 1755, and then he works on it, and it's eventually published in the spring of 1756. But already in January 2nd, 1756, you have a letter from Ludwig von Mey to Baron von Haller, who was a Swiss friend of the philosophe, where he says that he has friends that told him about this poem that Voltaire has written, but he's only read it to his invitees. I've gotten a hold of the 8 final verses, which I'm giving you in this letter. And in fact, this is really interesting. This confirms that it was, in fact, the earliest version of this poem, because our sequence liner stops with au sein, because we're using a modern addition. And in fact, this was the original end of the poem. Que faut-il, ô mortel? Mortel, il faut souffrir, se soumettre en silence, adorer et mourir. So it wasn't it's a rather pessimistic end to his poem. And in fact, it was so pessimistic that Voltaire decided he needed to change it. And so he writes to Elie Bertrand on the 7th of March, where he's thinking about cette dissertation me ramène encore où tout est bien. Je sais que dans nos jours consacrés, voilà. And then he adds it. And so he's playing with the ending, trying to get the right one to his friend Elie Bertrand. Then you have his original secretary, Cosimo Collini, who sends out a more definitive version to Sébastien Dupont, where he describes Voltaire giving this new version of the poem. You have another letter in March 27th, where Gabriel Seigneur sends again to Baron von Haller. This time, he was in the presence of Voltaire when Voltaire was reading his newly edited poem. We get the full ending, and he even refers to it as "Voici la conclusion. C'est tout ce que j'ai pu avoir de cette pièce retouchée." So I was only able to get the ending, but it's been retouched, right? It's been re-edited. And then finally, perhaps most importantly, in July 1756, Voltaire would have sent. We know he sent a copy to Rousseau, because Rousseau writes back and says, "I got your letter. A very pessimistic poem or something." But Jacob Vernes writes to Rousseau and he says, "Aren't you going to speak about this poem? It's circulating everywhere. You need to say something. Especially, I'm very troubled by this passage or this passage." And he goes on as I said it. And then we know that in 18th of August, Rousseau writes this 7,000 word letter back to Voltaire, this where he defends Providence in many ways, or at least the sort of Popian, Leibnizian, tout est bien dans le, you know, with all is well in this most best of all possible worlds. And so it provokes this huge debate, and then Rousseau claims that this is why Voltaire writes Candide. Voltaire says, "No, I didn't write Candide for anything to do with Rousseau," but it was still a reflection on the disaster in Lisbon. So this gives you an idea of where we can go, of how you can follow these sort of traces through the correspondence. Just to return quickly to the Lettres Philosophiques, you get another idea of how these texts weren't just published fully formed, like Athena from Zeus's head, that Voltaire was always retouching them. And our idea is that he does this in the correspondence, and this is why the text of the correspondence is so important, because he sort of throws out different things. He's always questioning the versions of the text that are out there. So this idea of authorship and authority is very important. And here, in the top one, he sends a letter to a friend of his, and he's talking precisely about the Lettres Philosophiques, which had to be published anonymously. It was published in London and in Amsterdam. It couldn't be published in France. It was banned in Britain. But he's still worried about the version of it, right? And so he says, "Well, I think about the chapter on Bacon, where I say, ses ennemis étaient à Londres, ses admirateurs. And I should have said, or there should be in the version, dans le manuscrit, ses ennemis étaient à la cour de Londres, ses admirateurs étaient dans toute l'Europe." Right? And so if we follow this back into Electronic Enlightenment, and we say, well, what's he on about here? We get two notes. We know it's Lettres Philosophiques that he's talking about, although that wasn't the title at the time. And in fact, he just calls La Dernière Épreuve. And then the second note, which is interesting, he says, this is Theodore Besterman, "Either Voltaire's memory deceived him, or the mistake was corrected in time, for it does not appear in the Amsterdam or Basel editions of 1734, nor is the appropriate leaf, etc., etc. L'Ensemble, which is the edition we use, went astray here in his edition by uncritically accepting Voltaire's complaint," which we can confirm if we look at the Lettres Philosophiques, L'Ensemble's edition, which is the definitive edition. He follows Voltaire exactly, word for word. "Ses ennemis étaient à la cour de Londres, ses admirateurs étaient dans toute l'Europe." There are perhaps other versions. If we go back into the 19th century and look at the Molon edition, it's a little different. "Ses ennemis étaient à la cour de Londres, ses admirateurs étaient les étrangers." So just a small difference. And then if we go out, if we decide this is an interesting problem, now let's submit this to the uncurated ecosystem of text, in this case Gale Echo, you could do Google Books or whatever, you find a resonance of this, which perhaps hints to there was a version maybe that just had Mesa-Mayor, maybe not, but this is a completely unrelated text, where it's one of these compilations of Le Voyageur Français. Clearly he's using Voltaire because this is a little bit about Bacon, and he uses a sort of third term. Ses ennemis étaient à Londres, ses admirateurs dans toute l'Europe. So ses ennemis étaient à Londres, ses admirateurs dans toute l'Europe is sort of added, so maybe there's another addition. But again, it moves us in the direction of traditional text critical questions, but in a way thinking about these as navigations or as networks. The second reference to the lettre philosophique that occurs in the correspondence, we get this. This is just an example of how sometimes scholarly editions aren't that helpful. So we get the quote, ce gouvernement c'est digne des Hottentots. We get a note from Besterman, and he tells us this reference is inaccurate. Point. So it's not a very helpful. It doesn't tell us where it's from. It doesn't tell us why it's inaccurate. It just says this reference is inaccurate. And then if you had a print book, you just say, okay, passer outre. But now we can look, while it is from La Voix du Choisir du Peuple, and is it really inaccurate? Well, there's one word that's different. Nous ne devons rien payer parce que nous sommes oisifs. Right? So the whole thing, ce gouvernement serait digne des attentats dans lequel il serait permis à un certain nombre d'hommes de dire c'est à ceux qui travaillent à payer, nous ne devons rien payer. In the reference, nous ne devons rien. So payer is not cited. I don't know if it really changes really anything as toward the meaning of the thing. I certainly wouldn't call it inaccurate, and I probably would have included where it was drawn from, but far from me to question Bestman. But this is an idea of where we can go with this sort of technology. But I think it brings us back, more importantly, thinking about the course, it brings back to ideas of networks and exchange and circulation of ideas, seeing how these things are. Look, this is someone that has read a lot of Voltaire. He says, I read in this work and that work, and he's trying to refute him. He sends this long letter to Voltaire. And so now we can begin to see exactly where these were and what editions they were. And so just to conclude today, this is a completely unrelated visualization, but you must have a visualization these days. But now we're thinking about what we're thinking about, and this is in fact not totally unrelated. What it is thinking about visualizing relationships of the borrowed passages, rather than an author sends a letter to a place and then you draw a line from those two places. These are in fact the number of borrowings. So each little dot colored is a different author. This is the 19th century collection of Fontext, which is the Artful database. These are works of poetry. And then the weight of the line, as in how dark it is, means the number of sequence, the number of I wouldn't say borrowed, of parallel passages, if you will, the number of that. So as an example, we have Baudelaire from Les Fleurs du Mal, which a little part of it Flaubert signs in his correspondence to Georges Sand, for example. So the idea here being moving from this macro analysis, from this visualization, and then drilling down, right, to keep up with the text mining metaphor, right? Here we have, again, this is 19th century novelist. This is Balzac on the right, in brown, in light brown is Georges Sand, so the two great novelists of the beginning of the 19th century, and we can begin to see who they borrowed from, who borrowed from them. They're interactive, so you hover over it and it changes colors, and you're very happy. But the important part being is that you get back into the text. So you can see on the right here that Balzac uses a little snippet from Proudhon, il vaut mieux être assis que debout, couché qu'assis et mort que couché, right? So, which Balzac changes, il vaut mieux être assis que debout, couché qu'assis, mais il vaut mieux être mort que tout cela. So it becomes this sort of weird thing for the Vicar d'Ardennes. But again, with ideas of moving, of macro analysis towards micro. And so here we have, and this is from the Perseus project, Perseus Digital Library, visualized based on shared sequences. This has been done by a colleague of mine, Helma Dick. And so we visualize these results, and eventually, again, you drill back down into the borrowings to try to see where this is going. And so with this, just to conclude, as I said, this is what I would consider a sort of a nice sort of way of moving through from distant or not reading into close reading based on intertextuality. And again, I use the term intertextuality fully aware that it is a thing, that it exists. And if I use it in France, they look at me, well, you can't do that with computers because computers can't read. But I mean, I think it's a good way to think about this, a way of identifying related passages, of moving from a general into a specific. And if we do look at sort of how Roland Barthes, so putting this in a longer context of 20th century scholarship, we look at how Roland Barthes talks about intertextuality and then perhaps his literary critical opposite, Harold Bloom, in the same year talks about the anxiety of influence. I think we can move in the direction of how these tools can help us move scholarship forward in this age of big data. So for Barthes, two texts, every text is an intertext, right? Every text is a tissue or a web or a fabric, a new fabric of old or bygone citations. And so the idea is to reconstruct that web and to see how all these texts are made up of all the texts that came before it. And for Harold Bloom, criticism is the art of knowing the hidden roads that go from poem to poem. And so given two poems, can we use technology and all the other sources we have to elucidate or lighten the hidden roads? And I'll stop there. And thank you very much.
Thank you.